Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. This week, Yitro. This week, Rabbi Mish Hammer-Kassoy discusses Yitro. Rabbi Mish Hammer-Kassoy is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Director of Admissions. And now, Rabbi Mish Hammer-Kassoy.
Thank you, Larry. This week's Parsha, Yitro, opens with a powerful interaction between Moshe and his beloved father-in-law. In reading about this meeting, to which I will return immediately, I can't help but think of the flurry of media attention devoted to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, feminist icon, the first female Jewish Supreme Court justice, and her magical marriage. NPR Radio states, "The Ginsburg marriage was one of those marvels of life, a 56-year-old year marathon of love and support. Martin D. Ginsburg met Ruth Bader on a blind date at Cornell. She was 17, he a year older. As he put later, she was a top student, and he was a top golfer. That characteristic belied his intellect, and she would often say that he was the only person she ever dated who was interested in her brain. Before Marty's last trip to the hospital, facing a losing battle with cancer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg found a letter that he had left for her on a yellow pad by the bed. It read, "My dearest Ruth, you are the only person I have loved in my life, setting aside a bit parents and kids and their kids, and I have admired and loved you almost since the day we first met at Cornell some 56 years ago. What a treat it has been to watch you progress to the very top of the legal world." Turning introspective about his own life, he told a friend, "I think that the most important thing I have done is to enable Ruth to do what she has done." On the last day of the Supreme Court term, less than 24 hours after her husband had died, an ashen-faced Ruth Bader Ginsburg announced her opinion for the court in one of the term's major cases. She was on the bench, she told colleagues, because Marty would have wanted it this way. With the notorious RBG in mind, the meeting of Moshe and Yitro feels even more poignant to me. Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moshe's father-in-law, heard all that God had done for Moshe and for Israel and his people, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after she had been sent home, and her two sons, one of whom was named Gershom, that is to say, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land," and the other was named Eliezer, meaning "the God of my father was my help, and he delivered me from the sword of Paro." The first thing that puzzles us, of course, is that Yitro, Jethro, is returning Zipporah after her sending away. We didn't even know she'd left. Rashi's answer is very famous. He suggests that when Moshe started out following Hashem's command to return to Egypt, Moshe packed up the whole family and started on his way. And when he met Aaron went ballistic. "Who are these people and where are you taking them?" "Amarlo, al rishonim anu mitzta'arim, v'ata balo, sif aleihem?" Aaron says to him, "What? We're already suffering here all in Egypt and miserable about it. And you want to add more people to the enslavement?" Acceding to Aaron's advice, Moshe, perhaps begrudgingly, sent her away from the war zone. "Okay, let's go with that for now and continue the narrative. If so, what we're witnessing is Yitro's orchestration of a great family reunion. Jethro, Moshe's father, brought Moshe's son and wife to him in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. He sent word to Moshe, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons." Yitro is directing all the traffic. And on the one hand, we've seen Zipporah's ability to take control of her own destiny and that of her children in the Malon in chapter 4. But we've also seen the tough traveling conditions and the way that she's been a victim of sexual harassment, or harassment at least, at the well when she met Moshe. So we're not totally shocked by Yitro's role as the initiator of travel. He is the head of family. But when we get to verse 7, my ire is raised. Vayetse Moshe likrot chotno, v'yishtachavu v'yishak lo, v'yishalu ish l're'ehu lishlom, v'yavo ha'ohela. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law. He bowed low and kissed him. They asked each other after their welfare, and they went into the tent. It's Yitro who Moshe is running out to greet and to kiss. They're called Re'im, sharing stories with each other, and then shockingly, they enter the tent together. We cannot help but remember the beautiful romantic potential of the tent. V'yevieha Yitzchak ha'ohela Sarah. Sara imo, v'yikachet Rivka v'tielo li'isha v'yahaveh v'yinachem Yitzchak acharei imo. Yitzchak brings Rivka into his mother Sarah's tent and makes him his wife and loves her. And that is how Yitzchak gets over the death of his mother. It seems to me that Moshe does not have an amazing relationship. Quite the opposite. The powerful connection between Yitro seems to highlight the deep rift between Moshe and his wife. Yitro seems to be the lover that Zipporah should have been. Okay, Moshe didn't have an amazing marriage, but is that abnormal? Perhaps rather than comparing Moshe to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it would have been more fair to compare him to the founders of our modern state, many of whom had famously difficult marriages. Herzl, Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir. David Ben-Gurion apparently only had time to be married to Paula at the municipal building in Manhattan and then immediately returned to a political meeting. Soon he was off on a speaking tour and then another until he finally enlisted in World War I's Jewish Legion. Not unlike Moshe and Zipporah, they also conducted a long-distance relationship. But in this case, we have some of the correspondence. She wanted him home, writing, "I got so thin, people don't recognize me, and my feet are swollen, and there's nobody to help me." "But," she wrote, "I suppose your ideal is greater than I and our future children." The exchange between Paula and David Ben-Gurion returns my attention to the words, "after he sent her." While Rashi, assumes that Moshe's sending Zipporah away was an act intended to protect her, many commentators read this text as not just a physical sending for her protection, but also an emotional sending away. The textual support for this reading can be found in the word shluchin, shilucheha, that he sent her away. The word lishloach is a key word for divorce in three different passages in Devarim, most specifically in Deuteronomy 24, where the key word lishloach is repeated number of times. V'chatav la'sefer kritut v'natan b'yada v'shilcha mi'beto. And he will write for her and put it in her hand and send her away from her home. Ibn Ezra suggests that the sending away is referred to in our chapter is really referring to a formal divorce, including a get. And the Ramban also makes that assumption and sees Yitro's actions as actually part of a not so subtle campaign to get them back together in light of Moshe's tremendous political success. Why did Moshe divorce her? Perhaps in line with the Ben-Gurions, as the Tiferet Yonatan suggests, Moshe was motivated to divorce Zipporah because of his blossoming concern with his national identity. Once he had decided to dedicate himself to the destiny of the Jewish people, how appropriate can it really be for him to be married to a non-Jew? While this reading is compelling, the sages focused on another explanation, his monastic and monogamous relationship with God. It's very interesting to me that the Gemara in Shabbat 87a sees Moshe's separation from his wife as one of several initiatives that Moshe took independently and that Hashem concurred with only after the fact. Why did he do it? The Gemara says, Nasa kal v'chomer ba'atzmo. He made a logical deduction. Amar, Ma Yisrael shelo dibra shechinai mehen ela sha'achat. V'kavad lazman. Amra Torah, heyu nechonim al tigshu el isha. When it came to Israel, God only spoke with them for a very short time. But yet God established a specific time that they had to be separated, saying, be ready for 3 days, don't get near a woman. And they had to be separated to be able to stand at Sinai. Ani shekol sha'a v'sha'a shechina medaberet alai, me, I don't have a date with God at Har Sinai. God talks to me constantly. Eino koveil lizman, and he doesn't give me 3 days notice. Alechat kam v'kama, I really have to abstain all the time, separate from my wife so I can be ready. And so Moshe decided to divorce, or to separate from his wife. Uminalan dehiskim a kadosh baruch hu al yado. And the Gemara continues to say, how do we know God agreed? Dichtiv, lech emor lehem shuvu lechem le'ohalechem. Because the verse says, God says to Moses, go tell the people of Israel, go back to your tents, i.e. resume your marital relations. V'chtiv batrei. And then the very next thing God says to Moshe is, v'ata po amod imadi. You should stay here with me. Meaning, do not resume your marital relations. So Moshe has made a decision to transfer the relationship that Bnei Israel were meant to have on a temporary basis, of abstinence in preparation for Har Sinai. Since Moshe speaks to God all the time, he should separate himself constantly, and God consents, saying that Bnei Israel, shuvu lechem le'ohalehem, go back to your tents, whereas Moshe, atapo amodi madi, you should stay here and not resume. On the surface reading, we can understand this passage in two different ways, I think. On the surface reading, it's all about sex. Our physical needs and sensual desires are somehow in conflict with our deepest spiritual achievements. Just as Bnei Israel abstained from sex in connection with revelation, so too Moshe, who was in constant contact with God, was he's too holy for physical and sensual pleasure. I think that's a really interesting idea that we should, worth talking about at the Shabbos table, if you will. Is there a conflict between our sexuality and our spirituality? At what level do our physical needs interfere with our ability to be like angels, to be purely spiritual? However, we could also consider this abstinence, Moshe's abstinence, more symbolic of a deeper, more complete exclusivity. Whereas Herzl, Ben-Gurion, and Golda Meir dedicated their entirety to their mission of building the Jewish state, how much the more so Moshe's partnership with God was so all-encompassing that it did not leave any room for other commitments, physical, emotional, or otherwise. I think that is also a very interesting idea. And I wonder how we are meant to relate to it. Are we meant to see this relation, Moshe's monogamous and monastic single focus, single-mindedness, an ideal that we should strive for? On the one hand, it seems significant that the initiative for the separation comes from Moshe himself. But surely Hashem's consent is meant to praise this total devotion. In Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, the Rambam emphasizes that Moshe's separation is a sign of his incredible spiritual stature. At the same time, he makes a point of emphasizing Moshe's uniqueness among the prophets. He says to them, don't try this at home, kids. He says, all of the things that were said, that we talked about, the ways of prophecy for all of the other prophets, everything that happens in prophecy is referring, to all of the prophets except for Moshe. Moshe, in Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah 7:6, is Rabbeinu Rabban Shel Kol HaNevi'im. He is the chief prophet. And his prophecy has a totally different character than the prophecy of all the other prophets, as great as they were. All the other prophets don't have the ability to invoke prophecy at any moment, whereas Moshe is in constant contact, and the nature of his contact is totally different. He stands k'malachei hasharet, like an angel himself. And thus he continues in halacha, at the end of the halacha, k'shanuvah mistaleket chozrim le'ohalam. And therefore, the other prophets, the great Isaiah and Jeremiah, when the prophecy leaves them, they go back to their tents, which symbolizes sarchei haguf kulan, all of your physical needs, just like the rest of the nation. Therefore, they maintain their relationships with their wives. But Moshe Rabbeinu, he did not go back to his original tents. And therefore he was separated from his wife and from everything similar. V'nikshared ato b'tzor ha'olamim. His mind was connected in its completeness to God. V'lo nistalek ahod me'alav le'olam. And he stayed in that unity with God, with that glorious unity forever. V'keren or panav. And he had a special glow about his face, v'nikadash kimelachim, and he was like an angel. So Moshe was on a very, very high spiritual level, something that really never happened again in the world. So he seemed that even Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos were not meant to try those things at home, and similarly, not us. Quite the contrary. In Hilchot Tshuva, the Rambam seems to emphasize that earthly love is actually an essential model for us in understanding what it means to love God. In Hilchot Tshuva, chapter 10, 2-3, the Rambam explains the commandment, you shall love the Lord your God. When a man loves the Lord with an appropriate love, automatically he will do all of the commandments out of love. And what is the appropriate love, asks Rambam. He says it's that a person should love God with a great and very excessive love until his soul is bound up in love with God and he focuses on it constantly as if he were lovesick and could not take his mind off of some woman, whether sitting, standing, even when he eats or drinks. So the love, how are we to know what it means to love God? We can abstract from knowing what it means to be obsessed with someone of the opposite sex or with a lover. We're shooting for that overwhelming feeling of love that we have for our earthly partners. If we know how to love another human being, then perhaps we have a chance of figuring out how to love God. So even if the Rambam considers monasticism appropriate to Moshe, it's definitely meant to be off bounds to the rest of us. So far, if I can just summarize what we've done so far, we've seen Moshe's separation from Tzipora is a sign of his tremendous spiritual greatness. The Tiferet Yonatan, sees it as a sign of his total dedication to his people, but the Gemara, as a sign of his total dedication to God. Either it's a simple physical separation, or perhaps it's symbolic of a deeper love and infatuation with God that doesn't leave any room for other relationships. So while the Gemara leaves open the possibility that this kind of obsessive, monogamous, monastic love is open to us commoners, the Rambam seems to knock that out for us, tell us it's something to watch on TV but not try at home. The rest of us, we do well to use our love for one another as a model for the kind of love we're trying to cultivate with God. It seems to me that there's another midrash that may take an even harder line on monasticism, criticizing Moshe himself, using Tzipora as the masterpiece, as the mouthpiece, I'm sorry. In Numbers 12, 1-2, you may be familiar, Miriam and Aaron spoke again Moshe, because of the Cushite woman he had married. He married a Cushite woman. They said, has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? you may be familiar with the reading of the Midrash, which is found in Rashi and others, that Aaron and Miriam were actually criticizing Moshe for his abstinence from the Isha Kushit. The Isha Kushit, according to this reading, is Tzipora, a beautiful woman. And he said, and they say, well, if God speaks with us also, and we have a family life, why can't Moshe have a family life? It's not right what he's doing with Tzipora. Setting the groundwork for the Rambam, God rebukes them by insisting that the intensity of Moshe's relationship is on a totally different level than theirs. And therefore, the fact that they are prophets is not proof that it's possible for Moshe to have a family life. Us mere mortals should figure out how to balance family and career, love for God and love for fellow humans. But Moshe's in a class all by himself. Another Midrash asks the question, how on earth did Miriam and Aaron know that Moshe and Tzipora's private life? Isn't that something that stays in the bedroom? And they suggest, and the Midrash Agadah by Buber, Midrash Agadah, the Buber Midrash, suggests a reading. When God had the 70 elders begin to prophesize, everyone around that saw them said, "Whoa, how lucky, how much nachas their mothers must be getting that they're seeing their children be prophets." Vaitasham Tzipora, and Tzipora was there. Vitchila onalahem, and she started to say, "Ashrei imotehen." Yeah, their moms are really proud. Aval oy lenashotehem. Woe to their wives. And Aaron and Miriam ask, "Why? What's wrong for their wives?" And she responds and says, "Oy, Moshe hasn't been with me ever since." She complains, and she herself is an unwilling victim. It seems to me, from the perspective of the Midrash, that if she is not a willing participant, happily supporting her husband, feeling that the most important thing that she can do, is back him up, then that forced separation on her cannot be okay. The Midrash, it seems to me, is criticizing, criticizing Moshe for his insensitivity to the plight of Tzipora, to which Miriam and Aaron respond. So to summarize, we looked at Moshe's dysfunctional family life, something that reflects the challenges of a work-life balance, as well as the complexity of monastic life, true love with Hashem, no room for anything else. Some people see this as praise, it seems like in the Gemara that this is praiseworthy, but also a critique as a way of clothing, some people see it as praiseworthy, it's most, that anyone could strive for it. Others see it as something that's praiseworthy in the case of Moshe, but it's not something meant to be tried at home. And some people see it as a critique. It's a way, it closes off a channel that allows us to really know God. I'd be happy to stop here. I think this is a complete thought. And if you want to turn off the podcast now, you can do so without guilt and get back to work. But if you're still driving to work or cooking for Shabbat, I'd like to close with a thought that I've been experimenting with, and I'm very much interested in your feedback about how this little interaction between Moshe and Tzipora might reflect to us also on the main passage of the Torah of the Parsha, the Ten Commandments. Maybe I'm wondering if. Well, I saw myself thinking about the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach and the Ten Commandments. What do they have in common, and how are they different? Six of the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach are found also in the Ten Commandments, which are revealed in this week's Parsha. Idolatry, murder, adultery, stealing, blasphemy. Blasphemy is parallel to taking God's name in vain. The command of dinim in the seven mitzvot to the Noahites is parallel in my mind to edut, the need not to testify falsely. And that leaves us one commandment in the Ten Commandments that doesn't seem to correspond, one of the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach that don't seem to correspond to the Ten Commandments. And that is the limb of the live animal. And then when I start to think about what do the Ten Commandments have, so I'm wondering, why isn't the limb of the live animal found in the Ten Commandments? Why is it important enough for the seven Noahite laws, but not important enough for the Ten Commandments? And then to understand what's special about the Ten Commandments that is not found in those seven commandments. And the main thing to me is the two luchot. The Ten Commandments are given in two tablets, and many of us are familiar with this idea that one of the tablets reflects the commandments between God and humans, and the other are commandments that are meant to be fulfilled humans to humans. And the Mechilta Midrash lines them up very beautifully, showing how Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, is parallel to Lo Tirtzach, don't murder, understand the greatness of God, understand the power of the godliness in the human being, and so on and so forth through all Ten Commandments. And I think that, that lineup in the Mechilta is an indication also of the way that we as Jews are meant to see our relationship with one another as a reflection of and a mechanism towards achieving our relationship with God. So the Ten Commandments, they're being broken up into two sets of five, meant to inform one another. Our relationship with God informs our relationship with other human beings, and our relationship with human beings also helps us build our relationship with God. I think that perhaps this focus on the humanist is also, explains why the power of the interrelationship between human beings as the central component of being Jewish perhaps explains why the lamb of the live animal doesn't make it in to our Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments for us are really about the power of the human being and the way the human being can create a relationship with God through his or her relationship with other human beings. My prayer to all of us is that we should fulfill those Ten Commandments and that it should in fact be a mechanism to help us create a relationship with Hashem. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Hammer Kassoy. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.